I know. You're done with inflation. But inflation is not done with you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Ryssdal. It's Thursday, February 10th. Good to have you with us. Sometimes the numbers just confirm what you already know. Today's case in point, the Consumer Price Index. The headline number was up 7.5% last month compared to January of last year. That's the biggest increase in 40 years. We'll get into some of the details throughout the show, starting with transportation. Used cars and trucks saw some of the biggest increases, up more than 40% year over year. And though gas prices fell last month, they were still 40% higher than last January. Add to all that the rising premiums for auto insurance and the cost of driving may be getting out of reach for some people, as Marketplace's Samantha Fields reports.
There was a moment early on in the pandemic when car insurance companies were actually giving their customers some money back.
The number of miles driven really radically decreased for a short time, and that led to a far fewer number of accidents on the roads and things like that.
Bob Passmore at the American Property Casualty Insurance Association says all of that reduced costs for insurance companies. But now people are driving again.
Today, we're pretty close to where we were at this point in 2019.
And those savings are over. Jeffrey Williams at Forrester Research says everything car-related is getting more expensive.
Look at the new car market. Cars are more expensive. Look at the used car market. Cars are more expensive. If you already have a car, if you go out and get new rugs to go in the car, they're going to be more expensive.
All of that means the value of the cars companies are insuring is going up. And so is the cost of car repairs and medical care when people get into accidents.
And these costs are pushed on to the consumer.
To raise rates, car insurance companies have to ask state regulators for permission, and they've been getting it.
I've seen premium increases in the range of 5, 10, and even 15%.
Doug Heller at the nonprofit Consumer Federation of America says the rate hikes are driving up the already high cost of car ownership.
That throws a huge wrench in the budget of people who are really just struggling to get by.
Many of whom need cars to get to work. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
No surprise here, food is also getting more expensive. Overall, food prices were up 7% last month from a year earlier. Together, meat, fish, poultry, and eggs were up 12%. One company profiting from those higher prices is Tyson Foods. The big meat processor told shareholders earlier this week it saw double-digit increases in profits last quarter. But wait a minute, aren't companies just passing on their higher costs to us? Well, it's not that simple. Marketplace's Andy Euler reports.
Just a few miles down the road from Tyson Foods headquarters in Springdale, Arkansas, you're going to find Wright's Barbecue, owned and operated by Jordan Wright. He says business is good, but he probably needs to raise his prices soon because of what he's paying for the raw product.
You know, when pricing changes on ribs from $1.50 to $2.05 a pound, you know, that's real margin that you've got to then go add to your menu and make sure you're not losing.
He says he doesn't feel guilty about passing that on to the consumer.
Cost that you can't control, you know, that's not really you sticking it to the customer.
Now, Wright knows how meat pricing works better than most. He used to work at Tyson. He gets why they're charging him more. Stephanie Mercier kind of doesn't. She's a senior policy advisor with the Farm Journal Foundation. She says at shareholder meetings of big meat packers, they're talking about consumer inflation expectations.
And they were essentially acknowledging in those conversations that they were taking advantage of the general inflation environment to raise their profits.
Tyson did not respond to Marketplace's request for comment before airtime, but economists like Lee Schultz at Iowa State University warn against relying too much on one quarter of data to tell us why Tyson's profits are up.
These cost increases don't necessarily happen instantaneously, right? And so looking at a snapshot in time certainly can mask the overall situation.
And he says retail prices adjust more quickly going up than coming down. So even if margins normalize, you might not immediately see that at the store. In Austin, I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Wall Street closed in the red today. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Sam Fields told us about the rising cost of owning a car these days. For drivers of electric vehicles and those who would like to buy one, there's another challenge: where to charge them and how long it's going to take. The Biden administration laid out guidelines today for how states should spend $5 billion in new infrastructure funding to amp up the country's EV charging network. The focus is on interstate highways. Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino has more.
For EVs to really catch on in America, says UC Berkeley's Ethan Elkind, they've got to be able to handle a good old American road trip.
This is a big psychological hurdle for a lot of people when they think about getting a vehicle. They think about all the potential needs of getting a vehicle, and the road trip looms large.
The new guidelines call for fast chargers to be installed about every 50 miles along the most traveled interstates in the country.
Fast chargers are really key because they start to approximate how quickly you can fill up a gas car at the gas station.
The promise of being able to recharge in about half an hour, pretty much anywhere, could soothe the range anxiety consumers cite as a top concern with electric vehicles. But most days, Americans aren't driving anything close to the 200-mile range of the average EV, says Jessica Trancic at MIT.
We're not traveling for 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day in our vehicles on most days. We're using our vehicle much less of the time, and we're stopping for more of the time.
The places where we stop the longest, like home and work, generally make the best places to recharge. Sam Houston is with the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Just plug in conveniently when your car's parked anyway. You just get used to the rhythm, the routine, and then you don't have to make extra stops like you would to fill a gasoline vehicle.
She says building out a better network of chargers in neighborhoods is also needed for widespread EV adoption, particularly for apartment dwellers who can't always install their own electric hookups. The infrastructure package includes $2.5 billion to help local governments make those investments. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
The need for more housing in this country is well known. Just today, the National Association of Realtors said the lack of homes for sale made home ownership even less affordable last quarter. The national median home price hit $361,700. That's nearly a 15% increase year over year. But prices went up even faster in many coastal cities. A new book offers some solutions to make housing more plentiful and more affordable throughout the country. It's called Fixer Upper: How to Repair America's Broken Housing Systems. Jenny Schutz is the author and a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. Among the many proposals Schutz lays out in the book are two ideas that sound pretty simple: build more homes where people want to live and stop building them in places we shouldn't. When we talked recently, I started by asking her about that first one.
We just need to build more homes in places that have strong job markets. So this includes a lot of our big metro areas, most of the West Coast, New York, DC, Boston. And even within metro areas, if we look across neighborhoods, some of the neighborhoods that have, for instance, the best public schools, that have great access to transit, these neighborhoods are in high demand, but they build almost no additional housing. And this is not a reflection of the market. The market wants very much to build more homes in these high-demand locations, but we have a whole set of policies that make it virtually impossible to add housing in a lot of these places.
And where do those policies come from? They're mostly local, right? And they're driven by existing residents who really don't want to see their communities change.
Exactly. There's a whole system of land use regulations which are adopted by cities and counties that put rules on where you can build housing, what kinds of structures you can build. And another piece of that is that local governments give current residents a lot of access to the development process. So if a developer wants to build a new apartment building or a couple of new houses, they have to go in front of a community meeting where the existing neighbors get to show up and say, I don't want more homes. I don't want more cars in my neighborhood. I don't want more kids in my kid's school. And the existing neighbors essentially have veto power to block new housing in these places where lots of new residents would like to live.
One of the fundamental challenges you talk about is this perverse incentive that homeowners have to fight new housing in their communities because they benefit from scarcity through higher property values. Is it about changing that mindset, or is it about basically forcing them, government stepping in?
Well, we could change their financial incentives in a couple of ways. One is that home equity is the largest single financial asset for most middle-income households, which makes them very protective, and they resist anything they think might push down their property values. And other countries have invested more in, say, public pensions that would make people less sensitive to their property values. The other financial incentive is that property taxes on people's homes are used to pay for things like schools and parks and roads. So local governments themselves have an incentive only to allow high-value homes to be built. And essentially what we need to do is change some of the financial incentives and think a little bit more at the regional level or the city level, because it turns out that some of the policies that are really popular with local voters are actually terrible for the region, for the state, and even for the country.
I want to go back to solution number two that I mentioned up top, which is not just building houses where people want to live, but build fewer homes where we shouldn't be building. And that gets into the perils of climate change, which we've been seeing play out all over the country. Can you talk about how the federal government incentivizes building in the wrong places and how we solve that?
Yeah, we have a really complicated and difficult to understand housing finance system and insurance systems. And all of these sort of diffuse the incentives, diffuse the financial risk that comes from climate change. So nobody has an incentive to avoid building in high-risk places. If somebody buys a home on the beach and it gets hit by a hurricane, some of the losses get borne by the homeowner. Some of them go back to the mortgage lender. But a lot of the mortgage lenders have sold the mortgage to investors. And it turns out that a lot of those are actually backed by the government-sponsored enterprises, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Mm-hmm. It turns out that taxpayers are actually bearing some of the cost from that damage.
Are there enough good places to build?
That's a good question. I mean, some of the safer places to build, for instance, in California, we shouldn't be building on what they call the wildlife-urban interface and the hills that are most prone to fire. We should be building in places like downtown San Francisco, because that's all concrete and that's much less likely to have a wildfire, right? Think of all of the mm-hmm. surface parking lots that exist in cities. If you build apartments on top of that, you could accommodate a lot more people rather than constantly pushing out into the suburbs where we have much bigger carbon footprints and pushing out to the edges of cities where we run into fire risk and flood risk much more often.
You write that reforming our current housing and land use systems will shake up the groups of winners and losers, which is a hard sell politically, getting anyone to give up something, right? What do you think it's going to take?
Well, we're seeing a lot more interest across the country at state and local levels in doing some sort of reform of zoning and land use regulations. Some of this is coming from, I think, a generational push. Lots of millennials think that they will never be able to buy a house because it's just getting too expensive and going further out of reach. But part of the reason also why I wrote the book is that I want sort of financially comfortable suburban homeowners to realize the system isn't working that well for them as it is. They are paying these costs through climate change, through the costs of not providing decent living environment for lots of kids. So, you know, even if you feel like personally you benefit from the system, it's not really as rosy a picture as you think, and there are outcomes that could make things better for a lot of us.
All right. Jenny Schutz is a fellow at the Brookings Institution and wrote the book Fixer Upper. Thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Coming up,
all kinds of women who want to come celebrate themselves.
And who wouldn't want to do that? But first, let's do the numbers. Oh, yeah, it's the trombones. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 526 points, 1.4%, to close at 35,241. The NASDAQ shed 304 points, 0.2%, to finish at 14,185. and the S&P 500 shrank 83 points, 1.8%, and at 4504. Rising inflation, of course, increases the prospect of interest rate hikes. That can mean more profit for banks, but J.P. Morgan Chase and Bank of America gave back 0.4%. Wells Fargo was down just a tad. The possibility of higher mortgage rates has some people afraid they'll miss their chance to purchase. But buyer beware, a recent survey from Zillow of 2,000 people across the country showed some 75% of home buyers have regrets about buying their new place. About 40% wish they'd spent more time searching and evaluating different options. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to, get this, 2.04%. First time we've heard that number, two, in a while. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Deaths from drug overdoses have risen sharply during the pandemic, driven in part by the growing use of synthetic opioids like fentanyl. The drug can be useful for doctors, but can also easily kill someone when it's in counterfeit pills or other drugs. There are ways to test for it, but in some cases, that's illegal, too. Madeline Beck with the Mountain West News Bureau reports now on efforts to change that.
The U.S. reached a grim milestone last year. In the 12 months leading to April, 100,000 people died of drug overdoses. A record. One thing that's driving the increase in deaths is the synthetic opioid fentanyl. But there's a way to test whether fentanyl is in a pill using test strips. They're inexpensive, about a dollar a piece. They work like a rapid COVID test. One line if there's fentanyl in a drug solution, two if there isn't. And some health officials say the tests could save lives. Arian Showers with the New Mexico Department of Health says when people who use drugs have the test, they're more cautious.
What we have seen over and over and over again is that it does change the behavior of the drug user. I mean, they will take less. They will take it at a slower pace.
So why aren't these test strips easily available? Crime labs across the U.S. are increasingly testing fentanyl using big, fancy equipment. Idaho forensic scientist Carrie Hogan says they're finding an increasing amount in little blue pills.
They are designed to look like oxycodone tablets. So they're round, light blue to green in color, and they have an imprint of an M on one side and a 30 on the other.
But while fentanyl is showing up more and more, the test strips are not yet widely available everywhere. As of last May, they were illegal in more than half of U.S. states, including Idaho. That's according to the nonprofit Legislative Analysis and Public Policy Association, or LAPA. LAPA attorney John Woodruff found that in the 70s, many states copied a DEA definition of illegal drug paraphernalia into their own laws. That definition includes tests for illicit drugs.
The question is, how do you get the inertia of having a law that's been in place for so long changed enough to sort of clearly make it allowable?
Woodruff says LAPA plans to draft new language that any state could use to pass legislation that would legalize the test strips. Many legislatures around the U.S. are already trying to change their laws. Nevada legalized test strips last year. But in Pennsylvania, the measure didn't get far. That's something Caroline Messerschmidt with Idaho's Drug Overdose Prevention Program has been watching closely.
They just didn't put the effort behind it that they needed to because there was this other thing called COVID happening at the same time.
Messerschmidt says that's why her health department isn't pushing to change Idaho's law this year. She wants to educate lawmakers first. New Mexico's bill also died in committee last year, and Showers says her state's failure to pass it cost lives.
Around 250 people would have likely been saved had we initially, when we first introduced this bill, if we had gotten it to pass. So we're too late.
New Mexico's health department drafted another bill this year. Showers says it goes beyond legalizing fentanyl test strips to legalize other kinds of tests.
Fentanyl probably isn't going anywhere soon, but we're already seeing analogs to fentanyl that are popping up in the drug supply that are actually not being detected by fentanyl test strips.
In the states where fentanyl test strips are legal, authorities can use new tools from the federal government. Last year, the CDC and other agencies made it legal for states to use federal grant funds to buy test strips in an effort to curb fentanyl overdoses. In Boise, Idaho, I'm Madeline Beck for Marketplace.
We've heard a lot during this pandemic about how working women, and especially mothers, have fared, quitting their jobs at record levels because of childcare responsibilities or dissatisfaction with their work. According to the National Women's Law Center, there were more than 1 million fewer women in the labor force last month than in February of 2020, while the number of men has rebounded. But when women get the support they need to get back to work or even start a small business, amazing things can happen. Here's today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Liz Hansen. I live in Evanston, Illinois, and I own and run a photo studio called Chicago Boudoir Photography. Boudoir is a fancy French word that means a woman's bedroom. But what it means for photography is it's a Victoria's Secret style photo shoot experience for the everyday woman. The women who come to our studio, they tend to be anywhere from 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. I've had a woman who was 69 years old who came into the studio. She was celebrating her 40th wedding anniversary and wanted to create an album for the love of her life. Just all kinds of women who want to come celebrate themselves, who want to feel empowered, who want to feel confident. So starting my first business with zero business experience was definitely a challenge. There were so many things I didn't know, and it's what you don't know that gets you. In 2018, I decided to open up my own studio. And then all of a sudden, the shutdown came, March 2020. As a photographer, I don't make any money if I don't take pictures. And I can't take pictures if the person doesn't come into the studio. And that was a really scary time for me. But fortunately, it was fairly short-lived. I was able to secure a PPP loan, which was very helpful. And when I opened back up in June, it was like the floodgates opened. There was this pent-up demand, and suddenly I had all kinds of clients. When the pandemic hit, my husband's employer, he works for a big university here in town, they sent everyone home, and he suddenly started working from home for the first time. And he, being home all the time, we basically had a flip-flop in roles. He became the lead parent and the lead child care provider while I started spending more time at the studio shooting clients and running my business. And it's just been a real shift in our marriage and in our family to have him be home and take lead responsibility on child care while I'm gone at the studio a lot. I have found so many people who want to come in for a fun photo shoot. Maybe their wedding got postponed, and so they do a fun photo shoot instead. Maybe they were going to take an anniversary trip, but that didn't happen, so they decided to do a photo shoot instead. And I've added to my team. I've added to my beauty team. I've hired hair and makeup artists. I'm currently working on training and hiring another associate photographer. We're expanding. We're looking for a bigger space, and so we're excited to see what's ahead.
That was Liz Hansen in Evanston, Illinois. And listen, we can't do this series without you. Let us know what's going on in your economy at marketplace.org/myeconomy. This final inflation note on the way out today. If chicken wings are on the menu for your Super Bowl Sunday, prepare to pay a lot more. Bloomberg is reporting a shortage that has restaurants stocking up on frozen wings and cutting portion sizes. Americans are expected to eat nearly 1.5 billion wings on game day. Billion. Jeez. The wholesale price of $1.75 a pound before the pandemic is now running about $2.60. How about some nachos? All right, that's it. We got to go. But here's your moment of economic context for this Thursday. I guess one more final note about those inflation numbers. I've talked on this show a few times about why rising rents and home prices have been slow to show up in the CPI. Well, now we're starting to see it. The rent portion of the index was up 3.8% last month, year over year. Owner's equivalent rent, that's how costs are measured for homeowners, were up 4.1%. They had been tracking around 2.5% to 3% for the past several months. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Amy Scott. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.